So, okay, well, it's my pleasure now to introduce, I can safely say that Stan is my senior colleague. Stan Shapiro has been a member of our department since he came to McGill from a PhD in statistics from Stanford University, which makes him one of the, if not the most solidly trained statisticians at McGill in a long time. He spent most of his career, he started his career, I didn't know this until I just read this, you started your career like many of us as a statistical consultant in one of the hospitals, which is what it says in your biography. You look puzzled to hear that, but
don't always believe what you read.
But then he's gone on to a long and illustrious career as one of the deans of clinical trials in Canada, focusing his work, at least as long as I've known him, on primarily on ethical issues and on the process of conducting clinical trials, and has made many, many contributions to the ethics of clinical trials, the conduct of clinical trials, and to actual clinical trials themselves, which, as we were discussing last night at dinner, the typical view of a statistics or biostatistics student when you're studying is clinical trials are boring. Then you go and do one, and you find out just how fascinating, challenging, and interesting from a statistical perspective they are. So the fact that you've done a lot of them, I think, is important in informing what you're going to tell us today about. I think this talk in another world was called A Random Walk Through Clinical Trials. But I'm going to turn it over now to Stan.
Now we'll see how much practice fits with the theory. One of the things I think it's worth mentioning in terms of our celebration is that it's almost like a family that we have, in that it's hard to mark start dates. It's simple in a trial because randomization is time zero. But Gilles mentioned yesterday he was taking the start as Corbett MacDonald's chairmanship of the Department of Epidemiology and Health. A few years ago, I think Jim and I had, at the request of the American Statistical Association's 150th anniversary, done a little bit of research in terms of the department's history, which went back to the 1800s in some sense. And when I started with the department, it was epidemiology and health. Walter Spitzer, a former chair of the department in about 85, I think, changed the name after consultation with the faculty to epidemiology and biostatistics, which I think more appropriately represented what was going on in the department at the time. Occupational health, which had been an aspect of the department, sort of left to go on its own prior to that, and then after struggling in the real world, decided to come home for a while and rejoin the department. So depending upon how you start to count, biostatistics has been part of the formal name for 30 years. Epidemiology has been there for the full 50 years. Occupational health has come and gone, so who knows what we'll see. But anyway, we can celebrate. What I'm going to do is actually not talk about 50-plus years, but 2,500 years in 25 minutes, although about 2,450 of those years will be dealt with very summarily. Okay. If we go back 2,500 years to Babylonian times, we have the reports that they had a very cost-effective healthcare system. We were talking about costs. They minimized consultant costs by taking their sick individuals, putting them in a public space, and asking passers-by what should be done. And we'll come back to this. We're going to see this at the end of the talk as well in terms of an analogous context. Fred Mosteller, who's touched the lives of many of you in the audience, for those who don't know, Fred was a statistician, which doesn't do fair justice. He was a Renaissance individual who was president of the American Academy for the Advancement of Sciences, chaired at least three departments. I thought four, but I couldn't recall. He chaired statistics, biostatistics, health policy and management, and what's the social relations. He also was a sexual counselor. Sorry, bad joke. Fred liked to take the start of clinical trials back to Daniel in the Lion's Den, also in Babylonian times, 2,500 years ago. But for most of us, Bradford Hill's trial of streptomycin treatment of pulmonary tuberculosis is taken as the marker for the start of the modern era of randomized clinical trials. I'm not going to talk much about that study, but I am going to talk a little bit more about a study that came fairly close to that in time and really had a substantial impact in us as epidemiologists and biostatisticians. I think should be more well regarded and known than it really is. And that was the Salk vaccine polio trial in 1954. So this slide is really an anomaly in the sense that you look at the smiling face of the young individual there and you might think, oh, this is someone who's engaging in some amusement park activity or something, when the reality was that polio was a devastating public health problem for much of the 20th century, certainly for the first half of the 20th century, and led to major societal disruption. Some of you may be old enough to remember the fear on your parents' parts in the summer and being kept inside, being told not to go to the playground. Movie theaters would be closed. Beaches would be closed. And this was really much more characteristic of the effect that polio had on society at the time. And it almost looks, if you recall, Raiders of the Lost Ark and the last scene with data being warehoused. People were essentially warehoused in these iron lungs. So a remarkable study came about, not funded by government, not funded by industry, but funded by public donations. Franklin Roosevelt, who was affected with polio, was the initiator of the March of Dimes. And that effort of millions of households across North America led to the development of a study being proposed that incorporated both observational and a randomized component. So the study involved over a million school children, 3,000 communities, was designed, carried out, and its dissemination took place in less than 3 years and was done for roughly $5 million. And even in today's cost accounting, that would be less than $50 million. And was a tremendous success. And the results of the study in terms of dissemination were released in a press conference at University of Michigan. And it really was like the red carpet experience for the Academy Awards, if you like. Media were the actual press conference was delayed before so that they could construct sufficient room for the media who wanted to be there. You can see the newspaper coverage, and it really represented a wonderful public health success and a wonderful attempt to engage the public in scientific endeavors. And in terms of the impact, we talk a lot about knowledge translation these days. you have Elvis Presley receiving the Salk vaccine, and if it's good enough for Elvis Presley, then it's obviously good enough for Tom Lewis. Okay. I want to briefly go back. The two books here, the bottom one by Harry Marks, who again was Hopkins-based and Harvard-based at one point, The Progress of Experiment, and the first one, a book by Rosser Matthews, Quantification in the Quest for Medical Certainty, are interesting histories of the evolution of clinical experimentation and clinical trials. And we heard yesterday a lot about the various factors impacting our work and the development of public health. And those are not unique features of the 20th or the 21st century. As I said here, succinctly put, Matthew's book chronicles some of the pivotal events in the evolution of the art of medicine into the science of medicine, and starting with the debates surrounding Pierre-Louis' numerical method in the 1800s, we traversed a series of intellectual, sociological, and political confrontations leading up to the introduction of a modern randomized trial. So basically, Louis' approach was saying, look, let's aggregate data. Let's look at individual occurrences and try and gain a comprehensive picture by aggregating them into a mean. And that was considered anathema at the time, because how could something as individualistic as a response to an intervention be considered to be able to be combined with someone different's response? So this battle waged for a substantial period of time, and it really transformed through the development of instruments that permitted quantification, such as thermometers, which were a contribution from German developments. And through that, there came to be a more collaborative, or less combative, let's say, relationship between individuals whose interest was at the individual level and those whose interest was at the population level, and that really advanced considerably with the introduction of the trial. That seemed to be a very propitious meeting ground for the two camps. So the change reflected a transition from a more combative to a more collaborative relationship, as I've said, between the focus on the individual and the population. But it really, as in many things, those of you who remember the Watergate scandal and the dictum to follow the money, the same thing essentially holds here. The Kefauver Commission really was driven by the thalidomide controversy. Thalidomide was never sold in the U.S., but nonetheless, there were cases that occurred in the U.S. and they occurred around the world. And the Kefauver Commission investigated how we could better protect the safety of populations and assess the efficacy and safety of proposed new medications. So that really drove modern legislation for regulation of new interventions. My mouth is going to hurt. Okay, it's hard for me to give a talk about clinical trials without referring to this paper. There's sort of two seminal papers in the fields of clinical trials. One is by Schwartz and Lelouch, entitled Explanatory and Pragmatic Attitudes in Therapeutic Trials. The other is the British Journal of Cancer paper, whose name I forget, but I call it the superstar article, because the authors are Cox, Mantell, Breslow, Pito, Armitage. Yeah. I don't know. Were both Pitos part of that? I don't think so. I'm not sure. Anyway, this paper really provided a convenient taxonomy for trials, because if you think about the situation with trials, trials are undertaken when there's a controversy. If there was no controversy, we wouldn't be in a position really to propose randomization to alternative treatments. We would just treat with the treatment that was perceived to be the treatment of choice. But when we don't have that situation, we feel we can approach individuals, we can approach patients to participate in the study without their being disadvantaged. And so, irrespective of the outcome of a trial, there's going to be controversy at the end, because proponents for treatment A, if that turns out to be a success, will be happy, but the proponents for the alternate treatment will look for the flaws in the study. Same thing in reverse. And if there's no difference between the treatments, then individuals will both be potentially unhappy. And so we can generate substantial debate, which may generate heat, but not necessarily light. And in a second, we'll talk about what these individuals did to try and improve that situation. The paper, I'm not going to spend much time on this, the paper was republished a few years ago in the Journal of Clinical Epidemiology. It had originally appeared in the Journal of Chronic Disease in 1967, and it was republished because of its major impact in the Journal of Clinical Epidemiology and also in the Canadian Medical Association Journal. But I want to take the opportunity. I also love this picture. This is a picture that was in Daniel Schwartz's apartment in Paris. And we talked a little bit yesterday about difficulties in terms of measuring exposure and also outcomes, and we have issues of relative outcomes or absolute outcomes. And this is a wonderful example of the difference between the relative and the absolute. Daniel Schwartz was a major figure. I think Rebecca had contact with him in Paris. He headed an INSERM unit, a very powerful force in epidemiology in France. But relative to his brother, he was the family dummy. His older brother, Laurent, who's in the upper position there, was a pure mathematician, and many of you know there's no Nobel Prize for mathematics, but there's the Field Medal. And Laurent Schwartz won, and the Field Medal is awarded every 4 years, and Laurent Schwartz was a winner of the Field Medal. So, you know, it depends where you want to be in the family. Okay. The first example in the Schwartz and LaLouche paper is the following. We want to compare two therapies for treatment of brain cancer. One is radiotherapy by itself. The other is radiotherapy preceded by a drug which may enhance the effect of radiotherapy but has no direct effect on its own. The drug has to be administered over a 30-day period. And the question is, which design do we employ? Do we employ design one, which has the experimental arm as the drug for 30 days and then radiotherapy, with a control arm that's placebo for 30 days and then radiotherapy, or design two, which has the same experimental arm, but the control arm is immediate radiotherapy? And it would be fun to engage in a discussion. We don't have the time to do it because we still have another 40 years to cover in the next 15 minutes or so. I'll presage sort of the debate by cutting to the chase with this. And it's like many other things that we face. The answer to this is, what's the question? If the question is a biological question about whether the drug does, in fact, enhance the effect of radiotherapy, then design one is the design that addresses that question. However, if the question is a pragmatic question from the point of view of patient care, Is it better to wait 30 days and receive radiotherapy after the drug or to receive radiotherapy immediately? Design 1 won't necessarily answer that question, and we would go to design 2. Okay? And just this simple distinction in terms of what they would call pragmatic or efficacy-driven questions have an impact all the way through from trial design, trial conduct, potentially even trial analysis, although that's a little more conjectural. There's another wonderful little piece that I'm going to skip here that drives that point home even more strongly, but I'll just go to the following, where Tex is saying, okay, stranger, what's the circumference of the earth? Who wrote the Odyssey and the Iliad? What's the latest paper that Sammy Suisse is going to come up with pharmacoepidemiology? What's the average rainfall of the Amazon basin? And his more tempered friend Tom is standing on the sideline, and he says, fart, you fool. You can't shoot first and ask questions later. Okay? That's probably the main message to take away. I'm going to skip over there. The next few slides are a variety of different studies that were done here at McGill. This was a study back in the 80s of febrile seizures with Peter and Carol Campfield. Peter is a pediatric neurologist. Carol was a pediatrician. And there were some interesting elements to that study. We'll skip it. This one is a worthwhile study to talk a bit about. There's other people whose name doesn't appear on this slide, but we have Walter Spitzer, who those of you who aren't familiar have heard was a former chairman of this department. Peter Macklem, who was a former chair of medicine, head of the Meekins Christie Labs, which our current dean, Dave Eidelman, comes from. Jim Martin, who's the current chair of medicine, Pierre Ernst, Kathy Gray Donald, Sharon Wood Daphne, who are all members of this department. Jim Hanley is acknowledged in this paper because Jim had a role in the very beginning. Tom Hutchinson as well was involved in the beginning. And even since the last couple of days, we've been talking about Oli to some extent. I remember this study was planned in the planning phase just about the time that Walter was recruiting Oli from Harvard, and he spoke to him about some aspects of this study because he felt that Oli obviously would be a valued person with input for the study. The study, in a sense, we saw pictures of iron lungs before. This, in a sense, was like a portable respirator. The intervention being assessed in this study was negative pressure ventilation. The underlying idea was that the respiratory muscles, which are involuntary muscles and never have the opportunity to not function, because if they did, we'd die, could be chronically fatigued. And some of the preliminary work that had been done to show that inspiratory muscle training was effective in certain segments of the affected COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, patients, wasn't universally successful, was because in some cases the respiratory muscles were so fatigued that they couldn't benefit from training. So the original idea here was to do a factorial study. And when we did some pilot work, we recognized that the logistics of doing that were just beyond our capacity to really carry it out. So the study became a parallel study of negative pressure ventilation with sham negative pressure ventilation. And that in itself presented a series of challenges because it involved people going in to the respiratory lab. If you really wanted to have an effective sham treatment, people had to believe that they were receiving an intervention. So there would be an hour period booked in the respiratory lab with individuals in the apparatus trying to adjust the settings to capture the muscular activity. There were four rooms in the chest hospital that were booked for this study. Patients came in for 4 days of training and had to be randomized ahead of time, because if they had been trained in active negative pressure ventilation and then randomized to sham, they would know it immediately. So we had to randomize individuals to the treatment that they would receive, which meant that we then lost people post-randomization who would drop out. So lots of interesting challenges with this study. And this study, depending on your perspective, was a failure or a success. It was a failure in that it did not show that negative pressure ventilation was in fact effective in terms of reducing dyspnea in patients with COPD. And it was a success because it showed that negative pressure ventilation was a failure in not reducing dyspnea, and it shut off a whole line of physiological research that otherwise could have continued for a prolonged period of time about chronic muscle fatigue. This is a little study that was done looking at marijuana in the treatment of chronic pain. It was one of the first, if not the first, studies to do so. It's interesting, and I think I incorporated here because the principal investigator, Mark Ware, who's a pain specialist in the system here, was terribly concerned before the trial went into operation that it would just be swamped with potential participants. You know, so he was worried about setting up a bank of phone operators to initially field calls. This was 2010, so I guess it was probably about 4 to 5 years earlier, sometime in the early 1900s to the mid-1900s, because it took us, I've forgotten the details, but I'd say 2 to 3 years to recruit 21 patients for the study. A not atypical clinical trial experience. You heard a little bit about this. This is the study that keeps on giving. This is going to take Mike Kramer on to his post-retirement activities. This was the Probit study, which again was a really fascinating logistical endeavor because it was carried out halfway around the world. We randomized hospitals. There's some aspects that I will refrain from talking about, because I would be concerned that Mike would adopt Tom's target practice approach in terms of the funding of the study. The study was supported by Health Canada and the Thrasher Foundation. I'll just stop at that, Tom. Anyway, the reason I say this study keeps on giving is that, as Mike alluded to in his talk, it was a large study which established two large cohorts that have subsequently been followed over time and continued to be followed over time. Okay, in the 3 minutes that I have left, 2 minutes that I have left, I just lost the third, I'll cover the remaining two-thirds of my talk. One of the things I want to point out and take the opportunity to, because it often becomes the subject of, I think, distortion, not necessarily meaningfully so, is people tend to regard trials as, I think they adopt the framework of a pharmacologic trial done under very strict circumstances and not representative at all of routine clinical practice. And talking about trials is talking about people. You have big people, you have small people, you have good trials, you have bad trials, you have smart trials, you have dumb trials. So this gives an example of three recent trials that, thank you very much, that have won Trial of the Year Award from the Society for Clinical Trials. And let's just look at the second one. The second one was an incredibly complex trial of intra-utero surgery for infants that were at high risk of spina bifida. So the issue was doing surgery while the baby was still in utero versus doing surgery after the baby had been born. And you can just imagine the complexities of that study. The last one was a study of an intervention which consisted of pregnant women sitting around a circle in rural India talking about issues of concern and issues of how to deal with the impending birth. You know, two vastly opposite ends of the same spectrum, two trials that were recognized by a rigorous group with regard to their meritorious nature in terms of trials. So when people talk to you about trials, not necessarily I would agree with, but necessarily not following and being able to inform routine clinical practice, I think you need to challenge that assertion very dramatically, because it's not the case whatsoever. This part, Robert in his introduction alluded to my interest in ethics, and it really, for a good portion of the latter part of my career, was really a very welcome element, because there were wonderful ethicists here at McGill who were interested in methodological issues. And as a field, we have a lot to contribute. I mean, the fun of being in the area that we work in is that we work inter-multi cross-disciplinarity with individuals who have other expertise that they bring, and we marry that with our expertise, and the sum is greater than the substance of the individual parts. So in common with most other forms of epidemiologic investigation, we're interested in looking at an exposure response relationship. That's what we're about. Okay? The difference is, in a clinical trial, we assign the exposure. We just don't observe the exposure. We assign it. So that imposes a very heavy ethical burden to make sure that when we do so, we're not knowingly disadvantaging individuals. And the debate about randomization is not necessarily a debate that was restricted solely to lay individuals and to the scientific community. In the mid-70s, you had statisticians like Ed Gahan and oncologists like Emil Freireich writing a piece in the New England Journal questioning doing randomized controlled trials, which generated a tremendous amount of anxiety among well-intentioned investigators. And the debate, there were some substantive elements to that debate which really could be dismissed pretty easily, but because the savings that you would obtain would really be illusory, except in very special circumstances. The argument, if we have a new therapy and we waste half of the patients on a control therapy, we're being very inefficient. And the variation would have to be so small to have that argument hold, that in fact it applied in essentially a minuscule set of circumstances. But the concern about disadvantaging patients, if you think of it again in the clinical context of someone approaching the medical care system, they're not approaching the medical care system to engage in a trial. They're approaching because they have a problem and they need to seek treatment for it. I know you're not going to put the times up thing. Benji Friedman, who was a colleague here, wrote a seminal paper in the New England Journal of Medicine, which introduced the notion of clinical equipoise, and saying medicine does not proceed on hunches. We're a science-based discipline, and the issue is whether, and well, let me just read it, uncertainty within the expert community, and the expert community here is really a proxy for the data. There's a lot of debate that can take place about who's the expert community. Is Jim an expert? Is Tom an expert? Is Sammy an expert? And what was really intended here was, what data do we have? And if we don't have the data to say that there, in fact, is a clear indication or an indication that treatment A is preferable to treatment B, we can say, Madame Boivin, you have come, you know, for treatment for your condition, and I personally, if you ask me, I might say that treatment A would be what I would recommend. But if you go across the hall to speak to my colleague, Dr. Suisa, who is equally well-schooled and well-qualified as I, and who I trust implicitly, he holds the opposite opinion. He would recommend treatment B. So I have to be honest with you and tell you that as a field, we really don't know what treatment is best. And so what we're doing is embarking on a study to attempt to answer that. And should you choose to participate, you will be assigned to either of these two treatments, and so on and so forth. So let me they really weren't very good anyway. there's two things that I'll do. One, this is a paper. This is not a paper. This is an editorial commentary in The Lancet, which I like to refer to, because it's based on a paper that The Lancet rejected. And then they wrote an editorial piece when it finally was published. And they say, in recognition, the journal editors have a key part to play in ensuring that published research is presented in a way that clearly illustrates why it was necessary and what impact a particular trial has on the existing state of knowledge. The Lancet has decided to update its policies in this area. From now forward, we will require authors of clinical trials submitted to The Lancet to include a clear summary of previous research findings and to explain how their trial's findings affect this summary. The relation between existing and new evidence should be illustrated by direct reference to an existing systematic review. And that was really based on this cumulative meta-analysis we did of a particular. These are all placebo-controlled trials. They were all approved by research ethics boards. They were all published trials. And it was clear we could argue about. The Lancet decided to say it was trial 12. You know, you could say it was trial 12, trial 13, trial 11, trial 14. But the answer was clear, that aprotinin beat placebo with regard to the outcome of interest in this trial. So there were a series of what one could arguably call ill-advised trials that continued to be done, and that shouldn't exist. That should not happen. And we're taking steps as a field. I want to just close. Okay, no. The principle of data sharing, this is from the New England Journal of a few months ago, the principle of data sharing dates to the dawn of scientific discovery. It is how researchers from different disciplines and countries form collaborations, learn from others, identify new scientific opportunities, and work to turn newly discovered information into shared knowledge and practical advances. When research involves human volunteers who agree to participate in clinical trials to test new drugs, devices, or other interventions, this principle of data sharing properly assumes the role of an ethical mandate. These participants are often informed that such research might not benefit them directly, but may affect the lives of others. If the clinical research community fails to share what is learned, allowing data to remain unpublished or unreported, researchers are reneging on the promise to clinical trial participants, are wasting time and resources, and are jeopardizing public trust. And it happens. And it happens a lot. And it's not only for-profit organizations deciding not to publish trials. I've had instances of colleagues here who have decided not to pursue publishing a trial for a variety of different reasons. They've used the argument, well, the results were presented in a meeting, so the abstract is available. But that's really not the same thing. So moving from the Babylonians exhibiting their sick in public places, we now have moved to the point where we are committing to put sufficient study details in the public domain so that members of the scientific community can provide more informed views. So rather than passing by and saying how we should treat the individual, now we pass by and say how we regard the study, and who knows what advances we'll make in the next 50 years. I want to make one additional comment, and then she will take your question. Tom, I think it's come up repeatedly, but just in terms of foreshadowing future ethical issues, I mean, people are talking about the area of personalized medicine, precision medicine. We've talked about generalizing results of a survey to a different population or to what population, if we're not sure of the sampling frame. We're going to have lots of fun, I think, when we start to target trials, you know, to specific populations based on their genetic makeup, you know, and then the next trial is proposed for a different population. Okay? Is it ethical to do that trial? Is there a reason to assume that the results that we've already seen would not hold in the future population? So what we need to do is have the rationale clearly laid out for why our patient population is as proposed in a particular study and whether we feel that the results would not extend or would extend, or otherwise we're just going to be generating a tremendous amount of subsequent activity which may not be necessarily productive. Sorry.
Professor Shapira, you are the godfather in clinical trial. But before I ask the question, you already explained, so I hesitant to ask again, because my question is that if you have a intervention, the evidence mostly from preclinical and observational studies, almost half and half, some say harmful, some say beneficial. So how to decide, should we even conduct the trial, and how much information you should provide to the patients who are volunteer, because you need to informed decision, but how to inform, because those evidence today may say harmful, next day may say beneficial. So that's it.
One of the slides I skipped was a slide that essentially attributable to Paul Meyer, which is related to your question, and it's in the context of the issue of decisions to continue or stop a trial. And Tom alluded to that a bit in terms of whether we continue a survey or we stop the survey. And at the point where he made the comment, he said, we don't have the methodology at hand right now. This was prior to stochastic curtailment, to group sequential designs, to alpha spending designs. He said, but I'm confident we'll come up with that. We will. He said, the hard question is what's the right metric? And that's related to your question. How do we balance, what's the net therapeutic index? How do we balance efficacy and harm? Okay? That's a difficult question. So for that we need, it's why there's no rote algorithm that we can just turn and get an answer to. So it may be that future work would be required to more specifically evaluate some of the potential risks associated with the treatment. It may be that we can look at the existing information we have and answer the question, but it's typically why there are committees who assess that, because it's a question that requires judgment. Sammy, who we're going to hear from shortly, deals with mainly with issues of assessing safety of medication, Because when we say, with regard to a trial, this trial is designed to look at the safety and efficacy of a particular agent, I like to always put safety in quotes, because we know we're not going to have a large enough study to be able to rigorously address that question. Okay? So if your question, it's hard to answer your question in general. We'd have to look at it in terms of the specific context and look at it with subject matter experts.
Stan, I think we'll wrap up there, and thanks, Stan, again, and reconvene at 11.